Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we're wrestling with something pretty fundamental, really. Making the right call when things get serious. We're talking about navigating all these opportunities, those really tough choices, and, that nagging feeling about the paths we didn't take. Our sources actually call that the lost opportunity cost.
Right, that lost opportunity cost. And it's such a tough concept because, well, you can only measure it after the fact. In the rearview mirror, looking back, suddenly everything's crystal clear. Oh, that's where I should have said yes. That's the opportunity I missed. But the real challenge, the thing we're digging into today, is that looking forward, the future is just, well, it's largely opaque, as our sources put it. So our mission here is to kind of break down those built-in limits, these invisible walls, really, that cloud our judgment when we have to make those calls right then and there.
Yeah, it's this huge paradox, isn't it? Everyone, I mean, big companies, individuals planning their week, we all desperately want to predict the future, to control it somehow. We crave that certainty. But the people we're drawing from today, who spent like decades looking at high-stakes decisions, they're incredibly frank about it. They say our ability to actually constrain the future, it's really, really limited. And not just by the info we have or our spreadsheets, but maybe more importantly, by our own sort of personal flaws. Our inadequacies. And we're going to get into those.
Absolutely. The author we're looking at is almost funny about it, sharing their own past mistakes in what they call this foolish delusion that maybe others can learn from them. But the deeper point is we're all held back by our nature, our upbringing, who we are. So let's maybe explore four of these constraints that seem to constantly twist our decision making, no matter how smart or experienced we might think we are.
Okay, let's kick off with one that hits innovators, founders, people like that hard. This tension between honesty and optimism. You've got to paint this exciting vision to get people on board, get investment. But then there's this almost ethical pull to list out every single thing that could go wrong. Sometimes, maybe too much.
Exactly. And that pull, that compulsion, is actually given a name in the source material. They call it the engineer's disease. It's this drive, this need to make absolutely positively sure that every tiny downside risk is laid bare for the customer or the investor.
But hang on a second, doesn't that just sound responsible, like really responsible? How could that be a bad thing?
Well, it sounds responsible, yes. But the argument is that commercially, it can be a killer. By focusing so heavily on the risks, you actually end up limiting your pool of takers. You only sell to people who are already comfortable with risk, basically. You miss out on that whole big group who, if they weren't completely spooked by the giant list of potential problems, might have jumped in, done well, and benefited hugely. So it becomes this personal barrier that actually holds things back.
That's an interesting way to frame it. Responsibility versus maybe effective execution. And that kind of leads us into another big constraint that's often hiding right there, our built-in bias against losing things, loss aversion, they call it. The research seems pretty clear. We generally prefer avoiding a loss over gaining something of equal value.
Yeah, and what's really key here is understanding the strength of that bias. Our sources argue it's not just about, preferring not to lose. It's that even when the math clearly shows one choice is better, like you stand to gain more mathematically, we're still wired to feel the pain of losing, say, $100 much more intensely than the pleasure of gaining maybe 110. That pain just feels bigger psychologically, whatever the numbers say.
Okay, that makes a certain kind of evolutionary sense.
Yeah.
Protect what you have. But the sources also suggest that a lot of the standard studies on this miss something huge, something really practical, the weight of what you currently hold, which, how much you have.
Oh, this is absolutely critical. It's all relative. Look, it's one thing to say you'd risk everything you have on a 50-50 shot to quadruple it when, let's be honest, you don't have much to lose in the first place. That kind of break-even scenario they use in studies, it gets way, way harder psychologically when you've worked for years, built up some savings, a safety net, and losing it means real trouble, $1,000. It's nothing to a millionaire. But to someone struggling to make rent next month, it's everything. Security, food.
So the actual context of your life situation really shapes your risk appetite, maybe more than the pure probabilities.
Exactly right. That's why the sources use that poker analogy. The person who wins the first big pot, they have a massive edge. And not just because they have more chips, it's psychological. Their bigger stack means each bet feels less risky. They can afford to lose a big hand and still be in the game. That changes how they play tactically.
Okay, interesting. Let's shift to the last constraint in this section, one that feels very character-based. The sense of loyalty. You mentioned that people really differ wildly in how much they stick to promises, to relationships. And this must massively affect long-term decisions.
Oh, hugely. It creates this fundamental split in how people operate, especially when the stakes are high. On one hand, you've got people whose entire reputation is built on my word is my bond. They won't break a promise, almost no matter the cost, history, the relationship that comes first. Then on the other side, you have folks who are described as basically transactional in nature. For them, the past doesn't weigh much, future consequences are secondary. It's all about this deal right now. Now imagine those two types trying to negotiate a long-term partnership. Very different approaches.
Wow, yeah. That transactional way sounds kind of exhausting, maybe. But I can also see how it might seem efficient in the moment. It really underscores how tricky it is to choose the right people to pursue opportunities with, not just the opportunities themselves.
Precisely. And that difficulty just gets amplified because, like you said earlier, we're practically swimming in choices.
Yeah, that's the perfect segue. We go from thinking about how hard one choice is to just the sheer number of choices hitting us. The author we're drawing on is very open about it, saying they get pitched opportunities from something like 100 companies per month.
Huh.
I mean, just think about that. That means automatically 99% of those opportunities are lost just because they have to say no most of the time.
And that basic idea scales down, you know? That sheer volume isn't just for top execs. Most people, even if they're not founding companies, face tons of opportunities daily, including really basic ones like choosing a different life path altogether. You know, deciding to find a job that pays the bills and is satisfying enough instead of pouring every single waking hour into claiming the ladder, maximizing the career at all costs.
Right. And this flood of choices brings up a really critical life question from the material. Does anyone actually look back from their deathbed and say, gosh, I wish I'd spent less time with my family or on my health or doing things I loved and more time grinding away on really tough stuff just for so-called success?
Mm-hmm.
I think we'll all kind of know the intuitive answer there.
Well, the sources take that common idea and add a really important layer of nuance. They actually question that old saying, if you do what you love, you will love what you do.
Mm-hmm.
They argue, well, that's not quite true. Because balance isn't just a nice to have. It's actually essential for lasting satisfaction. Think about it. If you love to laugh, laughing constantly, 24/7, probably wouldn't feel so great after a while. If you thrive on new things, you still need the comfort of the familiar sometimes. It's finding that equilibrium between different needs that actually keeps you happy long term.
And this is where they pinpoint what they call the real trouble, often seen in high-achieving executives. It happens when they lose sight of that balance, when they get completely fixated on the success of their venture. You know, success defined by external metrics, not their own well-being. That obsession starts to push aside their ethics, their family time, their health, even their basic humanity sometimes.
Yeah, that loss of perspective is maybe the ultimate tragedy that can come from choices. They let the chase for the what, the outcome, the money, the status, completely erode the who. Because fundamentally, life is about choices. And no matter what situation you're in, your choices, and crucially, your outlook on those choices, that's what really governs your life.
Okay, so if that's the case, how do you deal with the regrets?
Yeah.
The inevitable bad calls you did make? The author seems to land on this place of profound acceptance. They basically say, look, knowing what I know now, I wouldn't necessarily make all the same choices again. But crucially, they accept that the past is past, and I was who I was and am who I am.
And that acceptance, that's the real turning point in this whole way of thinking. The focus has to shift almost entirely from what you want to achieve to who you want to be. The sources get pretty specific about what this who means. It's defined by your core views, your thoughts. It's about your personal guardrails, specifically what you are and are not willing to do for what purposes. It's also about your willingness to actually share those views, how you interact with people, and maybe most importantly, how you think about yourself.
Huh. That changes everything, even down to first impressions, right?
Yeah.
Instead of leading with, here's my job title, here's what I do, the aim becomes trying to convey a sense of who you are fast, in like 30 seconds. Are you sharing your skills or your core principles?
Right. That first impression definitely carries weight. But there's a really important bit of nuance here, too. Yes, you don't get a second chance at a first impression, but feeling like you've somehow failed just because of someone else's maybe superficial reaction, that's a mistake. Impressions can and do evolve. The sources even share that little anecdote. Some of my best friends are people who I initially disliked. You have to allow room for yourself and for others to learn and adjust. Give people some grace.
Yeah, that makes sense. And it flows right into the final piece of advice from the author, which really pulls this whole deep dive together.
Yeah.
Basically, stop trying so hard to be perfect, especially perfect in other people's eyes. Instead, start trying to be the best version of you that you can be. Look, we all mess up. We've just talked about all those internal walls and biases, but we always, always have another chance to try and do better next time.
That really is the core strategy, boiled down. We're faced with this huge, often confusing number of opportunities. We know we can't perfectly predict how things will turn out because of all those limitations we discussed, cognitive, personal. So instead of getting bogged down trying to rewrite the past or obsessing over those lost opportunity costs with perfect hindsight, the better strategy, the more sustainable one, is to really figure out, who am I, who do I want to be, and then start consciously working to become that better version of yourself.
So, wrapping this up, what does this mean for you, listening right now, as you face your next big decision? Maybe it's about your career, maybe something deeply personal. If the quality of your future really is shaped by your choices, and if those choices are inevitably filtered through your identity, your who, then how much time are you actually spending intentionally defining those personal guardrails, those core views, that essential who, versus maybe just focusing on calculating the next transaction, the next outcome, the often fleeting what, something to think about.
Yeah.